I'd also like to thank the organizers for inviting me. And I was just telling Jean-Pierre before we started that I felt like a real graybeard around here. And I'm such a graybeard that I haven't really made the transition to doing electronic talks yet. So we'll do a mix of your graphs and other stuff. So I'm going to speak about accretion onto black holes. And I was asked by the organizers to give a talk that was at least partly targeted toward solar physicists, trying to explain a little bit about what dynamical processes are important in black hole accretion flow. So part of the talk will be on that. I'm going to talk about, give you sort of an overview of accretion flow geometry, and then talk about some specific dynamical processes, in particular, the magnetorotational or Balbus-Hawley instability. And then toward the end, I'll go on and give you a little bit of, give the disk people a little bit of new stuff to look at, some new numerical models that we've been developing at the University of Illinois. And that'll be work that I've done in collaboration with my graduate student, who's here, Jonathan McKinney, and with Gabor Toth, who's now in Budapest. So before we begin, this got a pretty picture up here. This shows the central kiloparsec or so of the of M87, and we think that there's a 2 and a bit by 10^9 solar mass black hole in the middle of the system, which is has point-like emission associated with it, and also has a famous bright jet, which can also be seen in the optical. So just using this as a sort of a straw man black hole system, there are a few things that solar physicists should realize about this system. First of all, the black hole itself is very small. It's about 20-some astronomical units in radius, depending on whether it's spinning or not, and depending on precisely what its mass is, of course. And that corresponds to about 1 microarcsecond, as seen from here. And that means that at essentially all wavelengths of interest, the black hole and the material immediately surrounding it are unresolved. The second thing that you should realize is that most of the energy in these black hole accretion flows is probably released very close to the event horizon. So within a few, perhaps 10, 20, 30 GM over C squared. And so that region, that dynamically interesting region where most of the energy is released, is also unresolved at almost every frequency. The one exception may be in the future radio and millimeter wavelengths where it's possible to do long baseline interferometry. Okay, the final thing that solar people should understand about this is that there's a classic model for these accretion flows, the so-called alpha disk model. And it's purely a phenomenological model which uses a parameterized understanding of our, or parameterized ignorance of our understanding of transport processes in disks to account for the structure, the density and temperature structure of the accretion flow. And I'll be referring to this alpha model off and on throughout the talk. Okay. So now we'll transition to old style, as things were 3 years ago. Yeah. Where's the focus on this fellow? Right here. Ah, great. Okay, so here's a beginner's introduction to the geometry of accretion flows. So because these systems are unresolved, all we have, the only information we have about these systems observationally is related to their spectral energy distribution and to the time dependence of their spectral energy distribution. And so our construction of what the central flow actually looks like is entirely theoretical. So all our interpretation of the observations is processed through the prejudices, which I'm about to describe here. So starting in the center, we have a black hole. Here's the event horizon, and in most coordinate systems, the event horizon is always spherical. And the black hole itself has two parameters, a mass and a spin, a spin angular momentum. In astrophysical situations, the charge of the black hole is not interesting. And then if the black hole itself is spinning, it's surrounded by a region called the ergosphere, which can be defined by the characteristic that any source within the ergosphere cannot stand still as seen by an observer at large distance. Okay, so moving out from the black hole itself, we may have a thin cold disk lying in the midplane of the black hole. The thin disk is likely to be approximately centrifugally supported. So V squared over R approximately balances the gravitational force. surrounding the thin disk is likely to be a corona. The corona is thought to be hot. Yeah, can I? As seen by an observer at infinity. So basically there's a dragging of the space-time by the rotation of the black hole, and that becomes sufficiently powerful inside the ergosphere that no observer inside the ergosphere can stand still. They have to be dragged around. Correct. Okay, so the corona is, of course, particularly interesting from the standpoint of generating high-energy photons, X-rays. There's considerable controversy over the last, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 years about the relative importance of the corona and the thin disk. Certainly there's some corona, some hot gas near the disk, which is needed to produce the high-energy photons that we observe. There's a class of models which essentially dispenses with the thin disk entirely and just has a hot coronal flow, which accretes onto the black hole. And those go under the general heading of advection-dominated accretion flows, or ADAFs. At the inner edge of the disk, the thin disk is thought to be located at a location called the innermost stable circular orbit, or ISCO. So there's my jargon. And the ISCO is the location where circular orbits transition from being stable outside that radius to unstable inside. So material is thought to gradually spiral in through the disk, reach the ISCO, and then essentially fall into the black hole. And the region where material falls in is sometimes referred to as the plunging region. So I've drawn a few magnetic field lines on this diagram in blue. Some of the field lines may extend out through the corona and to large distance and then thread the disk itself. There may be field lines which are entirely contained within the disk, and yet others which loop up into the corona. In addition, there may be field lines which thread the black hole, the event horizon itself. And some of those may connect to the disk. Okay, so this is the basic picture that we're starting from. Again, some people believe that the thin disk is absent close to the black hole in many of the systems, that there's simply a hot accretion flow, which is corona-like. Okay, and the final thing that I shouldn't neglect to say is that the key to the evolution of these systems is in how angular momentum is removed from the material, both in the corona and the disk. Because this material surrounding the black hole is approximately centrifugally supported, we either need to remove the angular momentum directly from the flow so it can fall inwards, perhaps by applying some kind of external torque by a magnetic field. Or we need to diffuse angular momentum outward through the disk by some sort of diffusive process. And this is likely to be caused by turbulence inside the disk or inside the corona. And a lot of the work on dynamical processes in thin disks that's gone on over the last few years has been related to understanding what processes might give rise to that turbulence in accretion disks, and how efficient it might be at diffusing the angular momentum outward through the disk. Okay, so here's a brief tour of what dynamical processes might be important in accretion flows. People have looked at a variety of models, and of course the first thing that people looked at many years ago were unmagnetized disks, purely hydrodynamic models. And it's likely that the densities are such in these systems that that a fluid approximation is a reasonable place to start. So if we're trying to understand what might give rise to angular momentum diffusion in a disk, then we're looking for some kind of linear instability, which could give rise to turbulence, and then the turbulence might cause the angular momentum to diffuse. If one looks at unmagnetized disks, the first problem that one runs into is that the disks are locally linearly stable by the Rayleigh criterion. So angular momentum increases outward, and in disks that are disks around black holes that have very little mass and don't have substantial pressure support, and by that criterion the disk is locally stable. It's now known that there are a wide variety of global instabilities in hydrodynamic disks. Many people here have worked on that. But global linear instabilities appear to require special conditions in the disk, and also appear to be rather weak in the sense that they don't lead to very vigorous angular momentum transport under the conditions that we expect in accretion disks. It's possible to set up globally unstable equilibrium, but then the development of these global instabilities then erases the conditions that gave rise to the instability in the first place. So people have also looked for local nonlinear instabilities in disks. And my view, although this is somewhat controversial, is that there is no evidence yet for a local nonlinear instability which might give rise to turbulence in accretion flows. Okay, so the next thing that people looked at were magnetized disks, and Balbus and Hawley in a 1991 paper discovered that magnetized disks with a weak field were locally linearly unstable as long as the angular frequency, the rotational frequency in the disk, decreases outward. So let me just say a few words about this instability. I think that many of you who do disk physics will have seen this before, but just bear with me. This is an instability which is known variously as the magnetorotational instability, as the Velikov-Chandrasekhar instability, because it was first discovered by a Russian named Velikov and subsequently developed by Chandrasekhar in the context of magnetized Couette flow. And it's been, in that context, it's been observed to exist in the laboratory. So it's possible to understand the dynamics of this instability with a very simple mechanical model. And when John Hawley gives this talk, this is a space shuttle in orbit connected to the Hubble Space Telescope by a loose spring. Okay, but here we can imagine that perhaps it's Balbus and Hawley connected by a loose spring. I'm on a live webcast, so John may be watching. I have to be careful. And these two objects are spaced very close together, and they're orbiting the some central body with an orbital frequency omega. And we imagine that the tension in the spring and the masses of the spring are such that the spring mass system has a characteristic frequency gamma. Okay, so it's possible to do a linear analysis of the system, linear in the sense that the separation is small compared to the orbital radius. And that gives a dispersion relation for the frequency as a function of the natural frequency of the spring and the rotation frequency of the system. And in one limit, it's very easy to understand what's going on here, because if the spring has a characteristic frequency which is very large compared to the rotation frequency, then one simply recovers a harmonic oscillator that's weakly modified by the presence of the rotational dynamics. And rotation is essentially irrelevant in that case. Okay. So, but the more interesting limit from the standpoint of disk dynamics has to do with the case when the spring frequency is less than or of order the rotation frequency. So in this case, an instability develops. We start over on the left there with a relatively closely spaced pair of masses, and then those grow exponentially in the linear regime with time. And this occurs because these masses are orbiting this way about the central object, and the uppermost mass has more angular momentum, and the lower object has less angular momentum because the specific angular momentum increases as r to the 1/2 in these systems. That's just Keplerian orbits. But the rotation frequency of the lower guy is higher, so maybe Balbus, and the rotation frequency of the upper guy is lower. So this guy wants to move forward in its orbit and pull ahead. This guy wants to lag behind and pull back, but they can't do that because the spring connects them. So you can see that the spring is actually pulling backwards on the lower guy and forwards on the upper guy, adding angular momentum to this one and removing angular momentum from this one. And as a result, this fellow wants to climb to higher orbit, and this fellow wants to drop down. And that process is exactly that transfer of angular momentum between two radially separated masses is exactly what generates the instability. So one can complete the analogy with a magnetohydrodynamic system by replacing the spring frequency squared with k dot va squared, where k is the wave vector of a perturbation in the disk, and VA is the Alfvén velocity, of course. Now you should notice that the magnetic spring can be tuned by adjusting the wave vector. So what enters into the instability is not necessarily the strength of the magnetic field, but a combination of the scale of the instability and the magnetic field. So the system has a maximum growth rate, which is basically a 3/4 omega, independent of the Alfvén velocity. If you decrease the strength of the magnetic field, then you also need to decrease the scale of the instability to get that same growth rate. So it's a remarkable result that the instability basically is, the maximum growth rate is approximately independent of the Alfvén velocity. And simulations of this show that the development of the instability leads to turbulence. Okay. There. Okay, so this is just a quick flashing of a local model simulation of a disk. This shows a very, very small piece of a disk. Actually, let me go back to this before I go on. What you're going to see there is a little box that focuses in on you can think of it as a region where these masses were attached together. The radial direction goes off to the right, and the azimuthal direction goes up to the top. And the colors in this simulation are going to show b squared over 8 pi, the magnetic pressure, on a slice through a three-dimensional simulation. And we've just put in some initial field, which I won't attempt to justify in any detail. But I'll just let this go, and you can see that there is an instability that develops and that acts to amplify the magnetic field and increases the field to a point where it's dynamically dominant in the flow. Okay, so seeing is believing. This instability leads to turbulence in accretion disks. Okay. This is ours, there have been other simulations done by Balbus, Hawley, Axel Brandenburg, and others. Okay. So just to return to dynamical processes in accretion flows. I was going to talk about radiation-dominated disks, but I think Jean-Pierre is about to give me the 10 minutes. Oh, okay, so I'm gonna skip over that. There's some very interesting work on that now going on with Neil Turner. Neil Turner is going to give a talk later in the week. Essentially, some portions of accretion disks, typically the innermost portions of disks, which are accreting at a rate which is close to a rate at which the disk radiates with the Eddington luminosity. In the innermost portion of those disks, the radiation pressure dominates the gas pressure, and that leads to a whole new set of interesting instabilities and modification of existing instabilities, which Neil is going to discuss. Okay, so another topic which is in this bit, which is dear to my heart, and I think also comprehensible to solar physicists, has to do with torques at the innermost stable circular orbit. In the classic alpha disk models, the disk simply ends at the innermost stable circular orbit. Material falls over that radius and then plunges into the hole with essentially no dynamical interaction with the disk. And Nowadays, we know that magnetic fields are likely to drive the turbulence in disks, and that opens the possibility of some magnetic connection between the material in the plunging region and the material in the disk. And this is an idea that's been explored by me and by Julian Krolik and Eric Agle, the co-conspirators or co-targets, I guess. Material out here in the accretion disk is sort of in a MHD turbulence state, and that turbulence allows it to gradually spiral in towards the innermost stable circular orbit. And then it makes a transition around the innermost stable circular orbit from a turbulent state where it's only has a very weak radial velocity to a more nearly laminar state further in, where it's simply plunging towards the black hole. Now it turns out that this region in between the innermost stable circular orbit and the black hole can be described by a quasi-analytic solution, which is closely related to the old Weber-Davis model for the solar wind. So material gradually lifts off the surface of the inner disk and then plunges towards the black hole, going through a set of critical points on its way in until it vanishes at the event horizon. And this is quite similar to models for the solar wind, where material is gradually lifted off the surface of the sun by, or maybe not so gradually, by a combination of gas and magnetic pressure, and then makes a series of transitions through critical points as it moves outward. On the sun, that magnetic field exerts a torque on the sun and gradually slows it down over time. In black hole systems, it's also possible for the magnetic field in the plunging region to exert a torque back on the disk. And if one does crude estimates of how important this torque is, it suggests that it can really be quite an important effect on the structure of the inner disk. And in fact, the effect runs as follows. If you make a plot of the disk surface brightness versus radius, which ends at the innermost stable circular orbit, and uses these phenomenological alpha disk models together with a boundary condition which permits a torque on the inner edge of the disk, then one can simply turn up and down that torque. So without a torque, the surface brightness looks like this, crudely, peaking at some fairly large distance from the innermost stable circular orbit, and then going to zero at the inner edge of the accretion disk. If one turns on a torque at the inner edge, there's an energy flux associated with that torque, and that results in brightening of the inner disk. So with a torque, the emission from the disk is more concentrated toward the inner edge of the disk.
On the left side of your diagram, the last stable circular orbit, where
the... Yeah, that's right. This is so roughly corresponds to that, yeah. Okay. So it's not entirely clear that when one actually does the calculation with a full 3D MHD model, that the torques are actually going to matter, that it's going to produce a significant effect. We're naturally motivated to do the global calculation. So let me just show you a series of global accretion flow calculations. And I'm going to start with a viscous hydrodynamics calculation. So this is a very crude model, sort of a very crude first step towards a global accretion flow model, where instead of putting in the magnetic fields, we put in a viscosity. And the viscosity allows the angular momentum of the material in the flow to change and allows the material to actually accrete onto the central object. And various people here have been deeply involved in these calculations. It's the first step towards a global model. So I'm going to show you some movies of the evolution of this system. And you're going to see color, which shows the log of the density. And cylindrical radius goes out to the right, and the black hole is in the middle. In these models, we inject material at large radius at about 300 N. And then it gradually accretes toward the center.
Is it important that the disk isn't very thin?
Yeah, it makes it easier to do the calculation, actually. So the vogue in numerical experiments for disks these days is to do what are called NRAFs, or non-radiating accretion flows, because one imagines that for various reasons, some of which are observationally motivated and some of which are just known corners of parameter space, these disks may radiate very weakly in some systems.
Charles, yeah. Are you injecting material with angular
momentum? Yeah, it's injected with almost a circular velocity at large radius. And we inject it steadily over the course of the simulation. So it reaches, a crudely speaking, a steady state. So again, I believe that color shows log of density in this plot. And the little black hole on the left of the image is just outside the event horizon. Now, I should say that we're treating gravity in this calculation using a pseudo-Newtonian potential. So we have a potential which is 1 over r at large radius and then becomes infinite at 2gm over c squared. But it goes to minus infinity at 2gm over c squared to mock up the effects of the black hole. So you can see material is gradually moving in along the equatorial plane, and then some of it gets ejected along cones at fairly high latitude. So this is sort of a warm-up calculation. The next step beyond this is to do a pseudo-Newtonian MHD calculation where this is a big movie. I'll take just a moment. Where instead of injecting material at large radius, we put material in a torus that would be in equilibrium if there were no magnetic fields. So it's basically a donut surrounding the black hole, and then we put in just a trace amount of magnetic fields which follow the isodensity contours, and this particular movie focuses in on the very center of this system. So we've done the calculation over a wider range and radius.
Still has viscosity?
No, this has no viscosity. Yeah.
Is this a slice or as we have?
This is an axisymmetric calculation. So there are now 3D calculations that are similar to this. We like to show our own calculations, so that's why it's an axisymmetric calculation. So you can see density enhancements accreting onto the black hole. Those are regions with low magnetic field. They're being forced in toward the equator by the high magnetic field in the surrounding region. And the turbulence in the disk is driven by this Balbisoli or magnetorotational instability. Okay, so quickly, because I'm just about to go over time, let me just say that one can measure the torque on the inner edge of the disk in these calculations. And this plot shows various quantities as a function of radius averaged over a region near the equator of the black hole. And this shows the gas pressure here. So there's a peak at the peak of the torus. This shows the magnetic pressure, and this shows basically the magnetic shear stress. So the quantity which is driving the magnetic quantity which is driving the accretion. And in classical disk theory, this stress vanishes at the last stable orbit. But in this calculation, the stress continues to climb inside the last stable orbit, and the flow is magnetically dominated in that inner region. Okay, Jean-Pierre will probably give me one extra minute to talk about. No, can't show that. To talk about the next step beyond the axisymmetric pseudo-Newtonian simulations, which is to go to full general relativistic MHD. So we have now done a very similar set of calculations where we put a donut around the black hole, and we integrate the equations of MHD in fully relativistic form. And we have an inner boundary. Yeah. This is a Schwarzschild hole, yeah. So we put the inner boundary here actually inside the event horizon so that there's no possibility of interaction between the inner boundary and the rest of the accretion flow because we use a set of coordinates, Kerr-Schild coordinates, which allow that. So this again shows the logarithm of the density. You'll see some funny stuff going on there at high latitude. This is the totally honest numerical talk where we don't hide our numerical garbage. There's problems in the calculation at low density. But you can see that that region gradually becomes involved in the accretion flow, and that there is the same development of the same magnetorotational instability in the torus itself at larger radius. So let me give just one result from this, which is that I'm the first ill-behaved speaker, and I apologize for that. This shows a very similar plot to the pseudo-Newtonian plot I showed you earlier, and shows that shows the gas pressure, the magnetic pressure, and a quantity which is related to the magnetic shear stress in relativity as a function of radius. And basically, this plot looks very similar to the pseudo-Newtonian plot. In fact, it's embarrassing how good the pseudo-Newtonian calculations are. But the one interesting thing that we can measure in this calculation, which we couldn't measure in the pseudo-Newtonian calculation, is the accretion rate of mass energy onto the black hole. And it turns out that in this particular calculation, the accretion rate of mass energy is almost identical to what you would expect from a thin disk model. So in this particular case, even though these torques are present, they're not energetically important in changing the structure of the inner disk. And that may change in the future with simulations of flows around rotating black holes. Thank you.
To one other speaker, this was an exception because he's the old man of the speaker.
The gray beard. Yeah.
Yeah, so he got 2 minutes more. Mitch.
Presumably, the effects of the torque are weakened by the gravitational redshift. Have you actually been able to analyze it in those terms?
No. we basically measure the angular momentum flux, which is a well-defined quantity, and we don't break it down into what one would see in this frame or another. It's all done in the coordinate frame, in the Kerr-Schild coordinate frame, and that's the extent of the analysis that we've done so far.
Just comment that in the limit that your numerical losses, that your free numerical losses of the energy, in a non-radius of calculation, there's no place for the energy to go back in.
Well, that's correct, yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, it can go through the outer boundary.
That's right, but that's the least likely. You wouldn't expect that under any circumstances.
Well, I'm not sure I agree. I think that one could have substantial losses from torsional Alphane waves, actually, through the outer boundary. And in this case, the outer boundary is very close to the electrolyte.
At this point, can you say whether there are any qualitative differences between your genuine Schwarzschild and
pseudo-Newtonian calculations? They look pretty much alike, I regret to say.
Can you
Yes, we can, and but we haven't done that. But that's an interesting question. Yeah.
Yeah, to drag you all the way back to your first cartoon, you showed a bigger corona. And I wonder what you think of a single field line going through. I wonder what speculation there is on this, the thickness of the corona and the size of the magnetic structure.
Okay, the size of the corona is determined by the temperature of the gas, which is determined by the equilibrium between dissipation of turbulence and radiative cooling. It's far from clear what physical processes are dominating on either end or either side of that equation. Just to give you a sense for the range of possibilities, people consider coronal models or ADAFs in which there's a two-temperature plasma where the electrons are cooler by of order the proton to electron mass ratio. And those systems radiate very weakly. And so the system basically heats up to a virial temperature and then is effectively cooled by radial motion. So those are by advection. So those are advection dominated. I think the natural scale is of order the scale height for the structure in the magnetic fields. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a question about the size, I guess the structure and energy budget in the magnetic field is generated by the constant. Is it large compared to the gas pressure, small? I mean, some of the plots are a lot lower than the gas pressure. What determines that?
That is an excellent and still unresolved, excellent question and an unresolved one. In the numerical simulations, the field typically, the magnetic field pressure typically saturates at a level which is between, say, a hundredth and a tenth of the gas pressure. And those are in simulations with gas pressure only. So there are other circumstances apply when one has radiation pressure present. Exactly what determines that is not very clear. I suspect that we're seeing a factor of order, you know, a dimensionless factor of order 2 pi squared, which is related to the curvature of the field lines that can fit within the disk.
I will allow myself to make a comment. Is that on your, say, introduction of the ISCO coupling, you showed a thin alpha disk, your simulation are big, correct. And the fact that the accretion rate is the same, that includes the structure is the same. And as you know, probably, I think that Bogdan Paczynski has shown quite convincingly that if it is the same, then the coupling is.
Well, I'm not sure I'm ready to concede that yet, actually.
But in any case, your simulation don't show thin disks. There's no simulation of this type showing thin disks.
Well, we can argue about what's called thin or not, but I think no very thin disks have been done. I'll concede that. I think it's just not clear what's going to happen when those calculations are done. And Paczynski's calculation used this phenomenological alpha model to describe the flow, and it's not clear that that's a good description for a magnetized flow when you're making a transition between a turbulent and an ordered flow.
That's a very good point.
So you've shown that as you went from pseudo-Newtonian potential to a fully relativistic system, not much change. You're also showing disks which are very thick and so hot, probably collisionless. And if you thought about moving beyond MHD, can you tell us what's happened in that direction?
All the simulations that I'm aware of either use the MHD approximation or use a viscous fluid model. I think our feeling has been that it's hard enough to do MHD, but it would certainly be interesting to look at some of the particle dynamics, particle acceleration in these flows and so on.
And one last question.
Will you do a rotating black hole?
So hopefully we're going to, one day we're going to turn on our code and jets are going to emerge and we'll be able to calculate the Blanford-Znaak luminosity of the hole. Not with the inner boundary condition, actually. Because we're using these Kerr-Schill coordinates, we can just put that inside the event horizon and we can do whatever we want there. It cannot interact with the rest of the flow.
Okay, so we have now a coffee break. Half an hour, we'll be back in half an hour.
Thank you very much. Thank you.